By way of explanation, a core value at Cambrai is trying to spend a little bit of time each week opening up the Bible verse by verse. I say a little bit because there's a fine line, isn't there, between a long, drawn-out sermon and a hostage situation. But also because afterwards, as you can see, we are keen to spend some time around the table, doing what Jesus told us with the visual symbols of bread and grape juice. Now, I wonder if these words sound familiar to you. We aim to encourage and equip everyone to become a fully committed follower of Jesus Christ. That is our strap line. It is our motto as a church. It is also our purpose to be a fully committed everyday follower of Jesus Christ. It's on your news sheet, it's on your church magazine, on your term card, it's on our church website. It is a summary of what we are here to do and a summary of what we are here to be as a church. If you think that sounds like quite a lot of words, let me reduce it to two. Following Jesus. Or let me reduce it to one. Discipleship. Discipleship. So our primary calling as a church from God, it is not to make rotas or organizing things or being concerned primarily about buildings or even legal compliance. It is discipleship. Discipleship. Being followers of Jesus. Discipleship. I wonder if that word has been on your mind at all this morning. If your morning has already been stressful, if the kids have been screaming, if you have been finding a parking space and that's made you late, it's possible that your mind hasn't yet had a chance to calm down and think about our stated purpose in being here, why we are here as a church, to encourage and equip one another in being disciples of Jesus Christ. Well, as our minds turn to that, help is at hand. In the passage that Izzy just read for us, we've been introduced to five disciple case studies. Each disciple encounters Jesus. That's our series title on the term card, Encountering Jesus. And so we've got disciple number one, John, the author of this book, who gives us the inside track on Andrew, his brother Simon, Philip, and Nathaniel. If we read the other three earlier gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's clear that these disciples were more formally called by Jesus later. But what we're looking at today is Jesus' words at their first encounter with him. Each disciple is different in temperament and in character, just like us. And consequently, each encounter is different in what Jesus says, knowing what each disciple needs. From each, we learn something about following Jesus. Whether we're here this morning already calling ourselves a disciple, or even if that's not quite yet us. If you are a potential disciple, we can say, think this morning about which of these encounters God is relating to your situation as we scan through these verses. So let's look first at Andrew and John. Andrew and John. Verse 35. John the Baptist, last week we called him John the Witness, again sees Jesus and says, look, the Lamb of God, Israel's sin remover. This is apparently a good enough sermon for two of John's disciples to cease following him and to start following Jesus. Well, it's certainly a clear sermon, if short. These two disciples are Andrew and, in all likelihood, John, the author of this gospel, mentioned as one of the first disciples in Mark chapter 1 and left unnamed in this gospel, as John refers to himself. So follow Jesus, they do. They walk directly behind him. That's what following Jesus means. Verse 38, turning around, Jesus saw them following and says, somewhat surprisingly, "What do you want?" If that sounds a bit abrupt, a better translation is perhaps, "What are you seeking? What is it that you are seeking?" They say, "Rabbi, respected teacher." And then you wonder, don't you, if Andrew and John have not fully thought this through. "Rabbi, yes, Rabbi, we were wondering. What were we wondering? Yes, where are you where are you staying?" Jesus says, "Come, and you will see." So they went and saw where he was staying, wherever that was, and spent the day with him. It was about the 10th hour, so starting at a 6 a.m. sunrise, about 4 p.m. Now, the language that John the author uses in his gospel, and particularly in this passage, is somewhat intriguing. On one hand, if you compare John's use of Greek with Luke's, John's got, we can say, very limited vocabulary, and his grammar, well, he wouldn't even pass many exams. But on the other hand, John's approach in his gospel is to have multi-layered meanings in his simple language, different levels of meaning. Quite often he'll have people talk at the physical level, but Jesus take their language and use it at the deeper, the spiritual level. So, for example, Nicodemus, later in chapter 3, speaks of physical birth, Jesus' spiritual birth. The woman at the well in chapter 4 speaks of physical water, Jesus' spiritual water. The crowds asked for physical bread. Jesus meant he was the living bread. The Pharisees speak of physical blindness, Jesus' spiritual blindness. In John 1, indeed in the whole gospel, the language is on one level talking about the mundane. What do you want? What's on your mind? Where are you staying? Where's your digs? Come and see. I'll show you. But on the next level, seeking and staying and following and seeing is the explicit language of discipleship. What are you seeking? Jesus was asking something deeper than they thought. They were following Jesus, but apparently they were seeking the wrong thing. I think he would ask you and I the same question. What is it that you are seeking? In coming to Jesus, what do you want? What are you seeking? Fulfillment? Happiness? Peace? Success? A happy marriage? Money? Andrew and John, almost a confession as John writes this, do not go to that level. They simply say, "Oh, we are seeking your address." As usual, Jesus is patient with this kind of response, and he gives them another chance. Only this time, it's not a question. It's a command, and it's a promise. Verse 39, "Come, and you will see." Come, and you will see. On one level, it could mean simply, "You'll see my house." But "see" is such an important word in this gospel. In the mind of Jesus and in the mind of John writing later, this meant, if you truly come to me, you will see spiritual reality. You will have spiritual sight. Coming to Jesus in John's gospel means again and again entrusting yourself to Jesus. So they come to him and they stay with him the rest of the day and probably at his house overnight. The next two verses, 40 and 41, show that they have indeed seen. Andrew says to Simon, his brother, "We have found the Messiah, God's chosen, the anointed king of Israel." Jesus began the relationship by saying, "What is it that you are seeking?" And now we hear Andrew say to his brother, "We have found the Messiah." They saw because they came to him and they spent time with him. The point is that if you come to Jesus and if you stay with Jesus, you see ultimate spiritual reality. Whether you're here this morning as a disciple or as a potential disciple, what do you seek? Know why you're coming to Jesus. And know what it is that Jesus is offering you here. Spiritual sight, ultimate spiritual reality, because you understand who Jesus is. That's Andrew and John. How about Andrew's brother, Simon? Andrew comes bounding towards his brother, excited. Andrew, who's usually timid, usually shy, here bears personal intelligent witness to the one he says is the Messiah. But not just a testimony. He grabs Simon's arm and he drags him to Jesus. As one commentator puts this, he thus became the first in a long line of successors who have discovered that the most common and effective Christian testimony is the private witness of friend to friend, brother to brother. And that's a great lesson for us, isn't it? Never be afraid to share your faith with a close friend or a relative, because they're the ones who know you and have reason to trust you. They know you're not a strange fanatic. They know you're relatively normal. Tell them about the Jesus that you have encountered, what joy and what peace he's brought to your life. Each time we come across Andrew in this gospel, he's bringing someone to Jesus. That's his evangelistic gift. Not preaching, but bringing people to Jesus. Actually, God only needs a handful of preachers in a church context, but he always needs more people who can invite and can bring others to Jesus. And I think it's John, the author's intention to say here, that's how discipleship happens. It's one person telling another. It's encouraging one another. It's equipping one another, one-to-one, passing it on. In this section, John the Baptist tells Andrew and John. Andrew tells Simon. The Greek in verse 43 probably implies that, in fact, Andrew brings Philip to Jesus. Philip then brings Nathanael to Jesus. And speculation now, Nathanael perhaps introduces Jesus to friends and family in his hometown of Cana, the wedding we'll be looking at next week. The power of bringing people. So Simon is brought to Jesus by his brother Andrew, verse 42. And what's the first thing that Jesus says? "Hi, Simon, I'm Jesus." No, he looks at him eye to eye and he says, "You are Simon, son of John. You will be called Kephas. He changes his identity. He gives him a new identity. Rabbis in Jesus' day sometimes gave nicknames to their disciples to indicate their special calling. But Kephas was an odd name. It's Aramaic, the language that Hebrew morphed into, for rock. And its Greek equivalent was Petros, from which we get Peter. Simon, you will now be the rock, Rocky. Jesus knows that before him stands a man who will be significant in the work that Jesus is beginning. And he sees in him strength of character. He sees in him future leadership, rock-like qualities. Yes, of course, Kephas will be impulsive. Yes, he will deny Jesus 3 times. But Jesus looks beyond such possibilities, knowing that he will one day say to this man before him, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." And we shall find the mature Peter, a principal leader in the young church in Acts. For us, whether we are following Jesus now or thinking about following Jesus, recognize that Jesus first receives us with all our qualities and our flaws, all our enthusiasms and our inconsistencies. And he calls us to be what he will one day make us. So don't expect instant maturity in young or new believers, but rather the purpose of God and the promise of growth and development. That's why we must invest in young believers and the young generally and be patient. But do recognize that in our discipleship, Jesus wants to change our identities. And friends, there is no identity for your life better than the one Jesus gives you. So that's Peter, Simon Peter. Let's spend just a couple of minutes thinking about the next encounter, Philip. Now, Philip's encounter with Jesus involves 2 words. Verse 43, follow me. That's what discipleship is, following Jesus. Maybe you're here and for years you've been sitting on the fence about whether or not you are going to follow Jesus. Maybe you've overcomplicated things, and in an effort to find out more, you want every answer to every question you have before you'll follow Jesus. But there is always more to know. You'll never know everything, but there comes a point where you have to weigh up for yourself what you do know, and you have to nail your colours to the mast and do a Philip. You have to say, yes. Yes, Jesus, you've asked me to follow you. I will follow you from today. This is a direct challenge to someone here this morning. Jesus says to you, follow me. Just as God seems to send many people in Muslim-majority countries without access to the Bible, visions of Jesus saying these 2 words, follow me, as the beginning of their faith journey, so God says to you today, John 1:43 in hand, follow me. And follow me is apparently enough for Philip to find Nathanael and say, verse 45, we have found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote. And we know where he's from. We know who his family is. Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Philip does follow and is excited. Does Nathanael share his enthusiasm? Let's have a look at this man, Nathanael. At first, no, he doesn't share his enthusiasm. He's openly cynical, we could say. Let's read from verse 46. Nazareth, can anything good come from there? Nathanael asked. Come and see, said Philip. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, here is a true Israelite in whom there is nothing false. How do you know me? Nathanael asked. Jesus answered, I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you. Then Nathanael declared, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Jesus said, you believe because I told you, I saw you under the fig tree. You shall see greater things than that. He then added, I tell you the truth, you shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Now, Nathanael, other Gospels call him Bartholomew, is not afraid to call a spade a spade. As I mentioned, he was from Cana, a rival village to Nazareth in Galilee. And just as Galileans were despised in general by those down south in Judea, so it appears that even fellow Galileans despised Nazareth, perhaps because it hosted a Roman garrison. I suppose it's a bit like people from England making Irishman jokes, but people from Ireland making jokes about those from County Kerry in the southwest of Ireland. Can anything good come from Nazareth? He says to Philip, who, also an inviter, replies, come and see. Of course, John, our author, is obscuring Jesus' origins. He's never called Jesus the Bethlehemite with all its royal Davidic overtones. He's Jesus of Nazareth. If you know your Old Testament, not a very messianic town. Later in Acts 24, Christians would contemptuously be dismissed as those of the Nazarene sect. Well, Nathanael might be a skeptic, but at least he's an open skeptic. He does come, and he does see. And the first thing Jesus says, knowing his hometown has been slagged off despite being out of earshot, is verse 47, literally, you are a man without deceit, without guile. You see, Jesus knows two things, two kinds of things about Nathanael. He knows what's going on inside, and he knows what's going on outside. You are a man without deceit is the truth about the inside. And there's a wink in the direction of two Old Testament passages here. First, it's a paraphrase of part of Psalm 32 about the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him. It's Jesus saying, Nathanael, you are authentic. You know your flaws, yet you tell it like it is. What you see is what you get with Nathanael. You're not two-faced. Yes, you don't like Nazareth, but at least you're not coy. But second, in verse 51, Jesus goes on to reference Jacob's ladder from Genesis 28. So you can't read this word deceit in verse 47 after the word Israel without thinking of Jacob in the Old Testament, whose name, Yaakov, means deceit. So it's as if Jesus is saying of Nathanael, look, Israel without a trace of Jacob left in him. Israel without the deceit. Jesus knew Nathanael on the inside even before he'd met him. But Jesus also knew Nathanael on the outside before he'd met him. Nathanael, he pushes back and he says, verse 8, 48, effectively, do you think you know me? You think you know who I am? A bit like if you met someone at a party and they pretentiously say, let me guess, you're a recently retired GCHQer, you made some money, now married with kids, changed careers, and now you're doing something a bit more creative. You think you know me? Do you think you know me? But Jesus is not being pretentious, and he is not guessing. He sees. He sees. He sees all things. He says, while you were out of my sight, I saw you. You were under a fig tree when Philip found you. That's the truth about Nathanael on the outside. Nathanael is apparently astonished. His cynicism disappears. And he says, verse 49, two more messianic titles. Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Now, what's the significance of being under the fig tree? Well, we can't be sure. Commentators make many suggestions. Had he done something terrible under the fig tree? Was he being lazy, having a kip under the fig tree in the middle of the day and Jesus was embarrassing him? Was he praying or meditating? Was he dreaming about Jacob's ladder? Was the fig tree an allusion to Micah 4 and Zechariah 3, the prophet's picture of the end of time, peace and prosperity, when every man is settled and sitting in the shade of his own fig tree? Well, we don't know. But whatever the significance, Nathanael knew that Jesus knew. Because Jesus knows Nathanael inside and out. You know, it is a wonderful thing for us today that Jesus, as the Son of God, as the King of Israel, that he knows our condition inside and out. Even if you're here and you wouldn't say that you know him personally and follow him, yet he still knows you. If you are alone and you get into trouble and no one knows what's happening to you, if you cut yourself off from people, Jesus knows. You will never be in a situation in your life where Jesus is not fully aware of what is going on in your life. But for those who believe, who put their trust in Jesus, verse 50, you shall see, that word again, greater things than this. You'll see Jesus' seven miraculous signs that make up John's gospel. You'll see his death and resurrection and the new messianic age being ushered in because Jesus, God's Son, has now come. Indeed, you'll see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. That is, with reference to this incident of Jacob's ladder in Genesis 28, we looked at it in our evening services back in January. You are promised a heaven-sent confirmation that the one you have acknowledged as the Messiah has indeed been appointed by God. The same God who honored Jacob at Bethel, the house of God, by having angels from heaven ascend and descend upon him, is now honoring Jesus as Messiah, the new house of God. And as disciples today, we do need to see this Jesus who gives us spiritual sight, who changes our identity, who calls us to follow him and who knows us inside and out. We do need to see him as God's chosen King. It's fair to say that Jesus in these verses is acting as a huge magnet, drawing disciples to himself then and indeed now, even through these verses. We all come, don't we, with different personalities, different temperaments, different flaws. But Jesus meets us each where we're at. And he tells us the exact thing that we need to hear. Whether it's, what are you seeking? You will be called. Follow me. I know you inside and out. What's the aim in all this? Well, at the beginning of chapter 1, verse 7, we read that the purpose of John the Baptist's witness was so that through him all might believe. And at the end of our passage, Nathanael does believe. Verse 50. That word believe occurs nearly 100 times in John's gospel. It means to follow Jesus. It means to walk down the road of discipleship, to participate in Cambray's stated purpose. And to believe means much more than having personal opinions about a thing, however strongly held. It is not a leap in the dark, but it is a commitment with eyes wide open. It is not relying on a hunch, but it is committing yourself to a person. It is believing Jesus Christ and following him as your Saviour and as your Lord. If you've never done that before, to follow him as Lord of your life and Saviour as your substitute for sin upon the cross. Today you can pray and you can encounter him for the first time. If you would already consider yourself a disciple, which of Jesus' words we've read today is he using to sharpen you in your discipleship? What are you seeking? You will be called. Follow me. I know you inside and out.